Okay, we are speaking now with Lorraine Moret. She is a geoscientist. She's also an environmental commissioner for the city of Berkeley, California. And she's the president of Scientists for Indigenous People and also one of the world's foremost experts on depleted uranium. Hello, Lorraine.
Hello, good morning. I want to say hello to all of the people in Nanaimo and Nanoose.
Fantastic. Yeah, we're very excited to have you on the show. Perhaps you could just start with, we gave you a bit of an intro, but you could possibly give us a bit of background as to who you are and how you got interested in the issue of depleted uranium.
Okay. I'm a geoscientist, and I got my bachelor's degree from UC Davis in 1968. And then I sort of went to Europe for 10 years. I call it free-falling through life, and went on a lot of expeditions and worked with Dr. Lewis Leakey and did all kinds of things. And I came back and did a master's degree on Near Eastern Studies after a visit to Iran, and I just fell in love with the Middle East. And then later I went back and did everything except my dissertation on in the geosciences for a PhD, and that's where I fell in love with atmospheric dust. And actually, the geosciences are a very good background to have to work on the radiation issue, because understanding how radiation cycles through the environment and then gets into our bodies, and what it does in our bodies is very interdisciplinary, and the geosciences are very interdisciplinary, so it's probably the best background that you can have. And I've worked in two nuclear weapons laboratories, the Lawrence Berkeley Lab for 5 years and then the Lawrence Livermore Lab for 2 years. Before I became a whistleblower at Livermore in 1991. And I experienced really horrible whistleblower retaliation. My daughter was kidnapped when she was 13, and I didn't see her until she was 18. They bankrupted me. It was the whole Karen Silkwood experience. And the way I really survived that, and what saved me my life, was going to Japan in the year 2000 and seeing the horrific truth about nuclear weapons in the Hiroshima and Nagasaki peace museums. And after that experience, I made up my mind that I would devote the rest of my life as a citizen scientist to helping people around the world and communities that have been exposed to radiation. And I can just assure you that it's been the happiest time of my life.
Wow. Why exactly, what were you whistleblowing about?
Well, I was working on the Yucca Mountain Project to store high-level nuclear waste from the nuclear weapons program and the nuclear power plants at the Nevada test site in this proposed area called Yucca Mountain. And I just observed absolutely the most horrendous science fraud that I'd ever seen in my life. And the Yucca Mountain Project is the most important public works project the United States government has ever undertaken, and it was absolutely the most fraudulent thing I'd ever seen. And I was so disgusted, I just walked out of the laboratory one day and never went back. And then, of course, they retaliated right away because I fired them instead of them firing me.
Right.
And that's how I began to understand when you cross that line, you cross over that line, you know, on something as important to a government as the nuclear weapons program, then you begin to see what is behind that whole apparatus, and all of a sudden it's in your face. Every day, every night, everything you do, every moment of your life, it's a mafia that you can never get out of. And so what really saved my life was getting high profile, and that happened because I went to Japan, and they were very interested in someone who was a nuclear weapons lab whistleblower, and they're the most sensitized country to radiation issues, of course, because of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met Akira Tashiro, a Japanese journalist who he wrote a book on depleted uranium and asked me to write the foreword to it. And that was the beginning of my discovery of this horrendous issue.
And has depleted uranium become your focus now?
Well, it wasn't intentional. It was just sort of accidental. It was because of my background and also the great good fortune of meeting a Manhattan Project scientist who had worked on radioactive materials from bomb testing at the Livermore Lab. And his name is Marion Falk. In fact, I'm sitting in his living room right now. And he's been my mentor and my father and my brother and my best friend. And he just patiently taught me all of this and how to think about it, how to write about it. When I wrote about the issue, he would go over it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure I didn't make any mistakes. And so now we're sort of doing research together.
Well, what we want to discuss depleted uranium, and I think that we've heard a little bit about it, and the word is thrown around in the alternative press, and the letters DU, of course. But I'm not really clear on exactly what it is, so I would like if you could explain to us what depleted uranium is.
When uranium is mined out of the ground, and two-thirds of the uranium deposits in the world are located in Australia, Africa also has a lot, and Canada has a lot of uranium. And so when it's mined, the uranium occurs as three isotopes, uranium-238, which is over 99% of what is mined, which occurs in nature, and that has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, the age of the Earth.
And is it radioactive right when it comes out of the ground?
Oh, yes, it's been radioactive for for 4.5 billion years.
Okay.
And then there's uranium-235, which is 0.72%. It's less than 1% of what occurs in nature. And that has a much shorter half-life. I'm not sure. I think it's 20 or 25,000 years. And that is the fissionable isotope of uranium that they want and they need to make atomic bombs or to make fuel for nuclear power plants.
Mm.
So it's a very, very small percentage. And then there's just a trace of uranium-234, which is less than a tenth of a percent. And so what they do is, because all these isotopes behave chemically the same way, they can't chemically isolate or extract the U-235, they have to do it by turning it all into uranium hexafluoride gas and then passing it through membranes. And because of the slightly different mass of each isotope, they're able to separate out half a percent of uranium-235. And so that is what they want. And the rest, which is left over, is called depleted uranium because they've depleted it in U-235. That's a bomb maker's term.
Okay.
And that's all radioactive trash, and it's 99.5% of what they mine. And so they had the Department of Energy in the United States had nearly 1 million tons of that stockpiled at Department of Energy sites with nothing to do with it. And it was proposed in 1943 under the Manhattan Project to be used developed as a radioactive poison gas weapon. And because uranium is a pyrophoric metal, which means that it burns, at fairly low temperatures, under 200 degrees centigrade, it will ignite, and then it burns at very, very high temperatures and forms a radioactive poison gas made up of very, very tiny particles. And so the U.S. Began developing uranium weapons systems in about 1968, and then they were used on the battlefield in 1991 for the first time in Iraq.
And what sort of weapons does depleted uranium show up in?
Oh, they make dirty bombs, dirty missiles, and dirty bullets, from handgun caliber size all the way to big bunker busters with a 5,000-pound warhead of depleted uranium.
And what if you have a gun with one of these dirty bullets in it? Are you safe?
Well, if you're shooting it, you can see on news films and everything that the bullets are on fire when they come out of the barrel, so you're going to be inhaling that just standing there pulling the trigger.
And how dangerous is it? What does it do to people that are exposed to it?
It's called Gulf War Syndrome. it has, because of these very, very tiny particles that are called nanoparticles, which means they're smaller than bacteria and even viruses, they go into the body, they're inhaled, they go through the skin, they go through all protective clothing, they go through all air filters and gas masks. If you're in an area that's contaminated, there's absolutely no way to avoid being exposed yourself. And these particles go into your body, millions and billions of them, and they're carried in the lipids and the cholesterol all over the body through the cell membrane. And when they get into the cells, they just start wrecking the whole cell. They act as nonspecific catalysts or enzymes in addition to the radiation and the chemical heavy metal effect. So they damage the DNA, they damage the mitochondria, which provide all the energy for the body, and they just cause general dysfunction.
And these depleted uranium weapons were used in the first Gulf War in 1991. I know that they were used, they're being used currently, and they were used in the Shock and Awe campaign, as I read in your, one of your articles.
The Queen's Death Star.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
And were they used in Kosovo, I think I read as well?
Very heavily. The United States will only admit that they used 10 tons. Well,
only 10 tons, eh?
Oh,
that's a relief.
Only 10 tons, but the Warthog shoots two tons a minute, so 10 tons is only 5 minutes of
Jesus.
Bullets. And actually, Lord Robertson, who was the head of NATO during the 1998-99 invasion of Yugoslavia, admitted that every missile the U.S. used was had a depleted uranium warhead. So we know also that the first 3 days of that invasion, which was only bombing, there was no action on the ground, that the nuclear institutes in Greece, Hungary, and Romania were measuring increased gamma radiation in the atmosphere over their countries, and also they were picking up uranium on air filters on the ground. So we know the U.S. was also using bombs with depleted uranium warheads in Yugoslavia, and actually they bombed the whole country. I had a friend, a geoscientist, who was living in, what's the capital of Yugoslavia?
Belgrade?
Belgrade, yes. He was living in Belgrade. And he said everybody's dying from radioactive bomb craters and radioactive tanks and bullets all over the place. The kids are picking them up. He said, what is depleted uranium? That's the first time I'd ever heard of it. And then I went to Japan a year later, and that's when I really began to investigate it.
And it's toxic at very, very small levels?
The toxicity increases as the size decreases.
What?
The smaller the particles, the more biologically damaging they are.
Is that just because it can penetrate and infiltrate the systems easily, more easily?
It's because of that. It's because of that non-specific catalytic or enzyme effect. These tiny particles go into the cell and they start turning cell functions on and off and mixing them up and confusing them and damaging information flow. And it's like releasing a whole bunch of rabid dogs out onto a racetrack in the middle of a race. And the horses just start flying and falling down, and that's what happens in the cell.
Do you consider, and does the United States military consider depleted uranium weapons nuclear weapons, or are they or do they call them conventional
or weapons of mass destruction?
Well, they are secretly waging nuclear war while calling depleted uranium a conventional weapon. But under U.S. federal code, depleted uranium weapons meet the definition of weapon of mass destruction in 2 out of 3 categories. And depleted uranium violates all international laws, all agreements. It violates the Geneva and Hague Conventions, and it very strongly violates the 1925 Geneva Gas Protocol, which prohibited poison gas weapons because they kill indiscriminately. And because they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars, probably billions of dollars, on the cover-up since 1991, I would say they are fully aware it's a nuclear weapon. And in fact, the U.S. Congress just introduced a new bill, and it's because of the state bills that I got going, making it mandatory for states to test the National Guardsmen for exposure and to also give them treatment. And so Congress was forced to pass a new bill or to introduce one admitting that every soldier has been exposed to radiation. This is the first time since 1991.
You mentioned, I think, in one of your articles that you said basically anyone who's been to the Middle East, especially to Iraq, since 1991 has been exposed. Is that
well,
correct?
I wouldn't say that everyone has. I would say since 1991, because in 1991 it was just the southern part of Iraq around Basra and down to the Kuwait border that was heavily contaminated. And the northern part of Iraq had not been attacked. However, after the no-fly zone bombing, when we know from the Aldermaston data, the British air monitoring data, they were using depleted uranium bombs then all over Iraq. So I would say since maybe 1998 or 1999, most of Iraq was very contaminated. And then after 2003, they just absolutely pounded the country from top to bottom and sideways, backwards, and forwards until the whole country is completely contaminated with DU. No one can go there now and not be exposed.
And you write also in this article, I keep forgetting the name of it, I'm sorry.
The Queen's Death Star.
The Queen's Death Star. That within about a week to 10 days, of these particles being released during the shock and awe campaign in Iraq, that they show up over 2,000 miles away in Britain.
Yeah.
So this stuff travels fairly rapidly.
Have you watched cigarette smoke? You can see it dissipating. You can blow a smoke ring and watch it sort of dissipating. Or you can think of volcanic eruptions, which are carried all over the world, these tiny particles. The same thing happens with depleted uranium. And not only that, what happens on the battlefield is when the uranium metal burns, it recondenses out of a vapor, and it forms these tiny, round, hollow balls of uranium oxides. They look like Christmas tree balls under a scanning electron microscope. And these are, the density is less than one, so they're very, very fluffy and light, and they're very, very tiny, and they are just carried on air currents, and also they become part of, they become incorporated into atmospheric dust and sandstorms that go all over the world. So we have seen a terrible increase, an epidemic of diabetes globally beginning in 1991, and people are getting diabetes a couple of months after being exposed to DU. And this is true of the whole Caribbean region and the Gulf Coast states, Texas, Alabama, Louisiana. They have terrible increases of diabetes beginning in 1991. The island of Puerto Rico, which is 8 miles downwind from Vieques Island, where the military tested DU bombs and missiles and bullets for 50 years, Puerto Rico has 25% of the population has diabetes. It's from all that DU. And there are huge increases in Japan and Alaska. Alaska has no nuclear power plants, so why are they suddenly having this huge increase in diabetes starting in 1991? It's global. And within a week or 2 weeks, it's from the battlefields in the Middle East and Central Asia, we're inhaling it.
Could you just briefly explain, you mentioned earlier Gulf War syndrome, and could you explain the figures in terms of soldiers in the first Gulf War that were injured on the battlefield and how many are on disability now?
I don't know that exact figure, but Major Doug Rocky, who was in charge of the depleted uranium cleanup team, has told me he's sick himself and half his team is dead. He told me 40,000 soldiers are dead from Gulf War One, and there's something like 400,000 who are on or 350,000 on medical disability and or who have applied for it. Now, I know from Terry Jemison at the Department of Veterans Affairs, he was interviewed by the American Free Press in August of 2004, and he said that since 1991 up to August 2004, there were over 518,000 Gulf-era veterans who are on medical disability.
Yeah, that's something. I read the same figures as well, over 500,000, and I kept reading them over, thinking, this can't be right. This is hard
to believe, and only 7,039 soldiers were wounded on the battlefield in the Gulf region in that same period.
And that's gone from 7,000 to over 500,000. I think that's an incredible majority of soldiers that were even involved.
There is, let's see, I've forgotten his last name, Terrell. Anyway, he's the chair of a department at the War College in Washington, D.C. And just a couple of months ago, he said that with all of the toxins on the battlefield and the conditions in the Middle East, and especially the depleted uranium, that we can expect 40 to 50% problems in health problems with our veterans in these depleted uranium wars, half of them.
And I just want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Loren Moret. She's a geoscientist and the environmental commissioner for the city of Berkeley and one of the world's foremost experts on depleted uranium. And I also want to remind people that this toxic substance, depleted uranium, that you're talking about, this radioactive substance, has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And half-life, does that mean that's the time at which it finally starts to break down?
Well, what it means is that if you have a pound of depleted uranium, U-238 now, which is mostly U-238, in 4.5 billion years, you would have half a pound left. And the other half that had decayed, it decays in over 20 steps into other radioactive isotopes before it finally becomes lead, and it's no longer radioactive. All lead comes from the decay process of uranium. And so what that means is that we've contaminated the Earth's atmosphere with much more than the equivalent of the atomicity equivalent of 400,000 Nagasaki bombs since 1991. And it's really a terrible truth. I was so horrified and in denial and shocked myself.
Yeah.
When I began to understand this, I said, I have to inform the public about this. This the public has to know about it, and we have to stop these weapons.
Now, there's a big, of course, there's a big cover-up, and you write that the British government facility, AWE, the Atomic Weapons
Establishment
was taken over 3 years ago by Halliburton, who have been
That's
in the
right.
press for all kinds of dastardly deeds.
Right.
And that there was a for the Gulf War I cleanup project, there was a no bid contract for depleted uranium contaminated equipment and facilities recovery plan given to Kellogg Brown and Root, who are part of Halliburton. I just wonder if this stuff is so incredibly toxic, how is it that somebody in Halliburton hasn't come out and said something, or somebody in, you know, other people aren't speaking out about this? If it's
Well, there's a whole lot of greed underlying this whole issue, and of course the former CEO Cheney is still getting paid and certainly getting hidden benefits from Halliburton. So if he can rake in more contracts, he rakes in more money. And the family that owns Halliburton, who hired him some years ago, is making billions and billions of dollars on it. And people who need jobs in poor communities and poor areas of the U.S. are willing to be hired and paid quite a lot every month. And they either don't know about it or they choose to ignore it.
I would assume as well that there might be a pretty high level of denial, that if you've been exposed to it, or you just don't want to know about it and you don't want to dig into it.
Well, you know, I've had drillers. I was a drilling geologist at the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Lab, and we were slant drilling under buildings, and this geologist came up to me one day and he said, "Did you know you're drilling through buried radioactive waste?" And I said, "Good God, no, we don't even have any protective clothing on. What's buried there?" He said, "Well, all the Livermore lab experiments for 25 years. And I said, "Oh, my God." He said, "Every isotope on the periodic chart is buried there." So I told the drillers, and they said, "Oh, well, we don't care. We can't see it."
Yeah.
It's invisible. We can't see it, so we're not worried about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
no, there you go.
So I know some of our listeners are probably thinking, "Oh, this is terrible," but, you know,
let's really shock them now. Let's bring it home.
At least it's, you know, it's kind of, it's in Iraq, it's halfway across the world, it's sort of, it does travel over here, but, you know, it, like you said, it's hard to see, and, you know, maybe it's not really affecting my life. And you had an interesting meeting with the mayor of Bowen Island, who told you something about something with depleted uranium going on locally. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I took a ferry out to Bowen Island last April, a year ago, to meet Lisa Barrett, who is the mayor of Bowen Island, because she had been the first mayor to adopt the Berkeley Resolution banning the weaponization of space that I passed in Berkeley. And while we were talking, I was really shocked when she told me that the U.S. Navy is now doing target practice in the coastal waters around Nanaimo and Nanus with depleted uranium. And it's because the Navy got chased out of Washington State around Seattle, where they were shooting DU into coastal waters, just using our fisheries for target practice. And so I think this is a very critical and an issue of great concern for the citizens of Nanaimo and Nanus. And I want to encourage them to also look into their pension funds and see what U.S. weapons manufacturers, their pension funds are invested in, because I learned that $6 billion in British Columbian pension funds are invested in 251 U.S. weapons manufacturers. And until we take the profit out of war, the wars will continue. And Lavaland is a Canadian corporation, is also manufacturing depleted uranium weapons for the U.S. military.
SNC-Lavalin. I understand they manufacture between 300 to 500 million bullets alone every year for use by the United States military and the Canadian military, I'm sure.
That's right.
Can you tell us, if you know, how long has the depleted uranium being shot into Nanoose Bay? How long has that been going on for, the testing?
I would say 3 to 5 years, because the citizens of Washington State worked very, very hard to stop the Navy. And fortunately, they had, actually, it was an accident, the manner in which they discovered that the Navy was using DU in Washington coastal waters. The Coast Guard gets their ammunition from the Navy, and the Coast Guard in Seattle received a shipment of handgun bullets and discovered they were radioactive. It was depleted uranium handgun bullets, and they were furious, so they returned them to the Navy and said, you know, we can't possibly use those. Send us some conventional bullets. And then the citizens began digging into the depleted uranium issue and discovered that nearly all of the depleted uranium weaponry that our military uses in those battlefields, you know, across the seas, is actually shipped out through the Indian Island Munitions Depot near Port Townsend, just a little west of Seattle. So that's a terrible hazard to you, too, because if that depot ever caught on fire, it would burn for days. There's no way to put out depleted uranium fires, and you would all be exposed as well.
There was a battle for the Nanoose Bay testing grounds, and in fact, our provincial government tried to take back the land, or tried to stop the American Navy from testing there. And
how long ago did that?
That must have been about 10 years ago.
It was
the previous government that we had. It was a different government, and then what happened was the federal government under Jean Chrétien stepped in and took the land away from the province, and then let the military proceed. And there was a big battle, and I believe that it's still in some way wrapped up in the courts. There's a local lawyer, Green Party member named David Wright, who was involved as the lawyer. But we never heard anything about the depleted uranium. We were told that they were using nuclear weapons, but they were not armed with any warheads. They were just sort of like...
it's depleted uranium. It's a nuclear weapon.
Oh, I know, but we were led to believe that they weren't in any way nuclear, that they were they didn't have warheads on them. They were just sort of like empty torpedoes, if you will. And
what they do is they
practice shooting nuclear weapons by using depleted uranium as the warhead.
How did the mayor of Bowen Island find this out? Because I noticed that there isn't really a lot of information out there. I think you and her are the only people that have mentioned this.
Oh, no, it's on the Internet. I found articles about it. I will contact her and ask her where she got that information.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an Internet link?
I have an article that you wrote where you mention it and you mention her, but I haven't found
what
a lot
I'll
of
do is I'll find out from her and I'll get more information.
Yeah, we'll do a search as well. But so just to move on to a little bit of a different subject, you just recently went to Japan, did you not?
Yes, I did.
And did you find out more things there?
Oh, yes.
What was your trip about?
I took Dr. Ernest Sternglass with me, and he is the number one enemy of the nuclear establishment in the United States. And he actually testified in Congress in 1963 for President Kennedy and helped convince the Senate to sign the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which ended atmospheric testing for Russia and the U.S. And we went to a genocide conference in Hiroshima at the Hiroshima Peace Institute. It was about a week long. That was very, very interesting. And Dr. Sternglass gave a groundbreaking paper on the fact that the U.S. government is deliberately shipping radioactive contaminated milk and dairy products selectively into black inner city communities in the U.S. and using it as a genocidal weapon against blacks in America. And we've proved this in about six states using U.S. government data, and it was an accidental discovery by Dr. Jay Gould, who wrote about it in his book, Deadly Deceit, Low-Level Radiation, High-Level Cover-Up. And this has been confirmed in other states now, and it's actually radiation has been used as a very racist weapon since 1945. And the first people exposed to radiation were the bomb testing radiation were the Native Americans who were exposed in New Mexico from the Trinity test, which was conducted just before they bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. So his paper was very, very important. And then I talked about the genocidal effects of the depleted uranium that's been used in the Middle East and Central Asia and Yugoslavia. And this is really very, very, very badly targeted and will have a terrible genetic effect. It's destroying the genetic future of vast populations in those regions, and they're almost all Muslim.
It sounds like almost an insurmountable evil, not to put too dramatic a spin on it, but...
Well, you know, depleted uranium is the Trojan horse of nuclear war. That's what I call it. And it keeps giving, it keeps killing. There's no way to turn it off, and there's no way to clean it up. And so I began to investigate who had made the decision to use these weapons and who was profiting and benefiting. And it's taken me years, but I finally was able to discover that the British royal family, specifically the Queen of England, owns tremendous holdings in uranium, primarily in Australia, Africa, and Canada, and that she privately owns much of Rio Tinto mines, and a Nazi who changed his name and moved to England, his name is Tiny Rowland, was the biggest Western businessman in Africa, and he set up Rio Tinto mines for the Queen of England. And if the U.S., if her buccaneers, Cheney and Bush, were not pushing nuclear power plants all over the world, her uranium holdings would just be worthless because almost the only use for uranium in large amounts is nuclear power plants. And so there's clearly a hidden partnership between the British royal family and the Bush, Cheney, cabal, and GE and Westinghouse, because GE and Westinghouse nuclear power plant designs are used in 85% of the commercial reactors around the world.
Unbelievable.
My God.
So that's where we get the Queen's Death Star.
That's why I wrote the Queen's Death Star.
Wow. But if they're profiting off of nuclear power plants, why use the depleted uranium? Just as a way to dispose of it, or as an added little side bonus?
It works good on weapons.
Well, if you read Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, it's basically our U.S. foreign policy that's being carried out, and it was all planned in the 60s and 70s. The reason they're using depleted uranium is the United States has to control vast oil reserves because we have an oil economy, a petroleum economy, and those vast oil reserves happen to be oceans away from the United States in the Middle East and Central Asia and also the Indian Ocean region. And so how can we control populations living in areas that we need to have control of the mineral resources? And we could only do that because they outnumber us. So the only way we can do it is to poison them. I mean, the U.S. started out poisoning American Indians by giving them smallpox contaminated blankets
so they
could steal all their land. So this is nothing new.
Well, I'm afraid we're just out of time, and we have to wrap this up. But this has been a brilliant interview.
My goodness, we'll have to do it again.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, I would like to ask you in closing, it seems to me that to go up against to go up against Queen Elizabeth and the Bush-Cheney cabal is a bit of a battle.
It's really easy. Start telling everyone you know. The Queen is terribly embarrassed by this being public knowledge, because she already got caught by Dr. Jay Gould, and he was investigating why uranium prices were going up all over the world during the oil embargo. And that's how he discovered the British royal family owned so much uranium. And when he reported that to Westinghouse, who had hired him to investigate, the Queen quietly settled out of court.
Very interesting.
She doesn't want this to be public knowledge. She's poisoning the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've been responsible for getting a lot of resolutions and bills concerning depleted uranium passed, and locally, Bowen Island, which is quite close to here, passed the Berkeley resolution, which is
right.
Is that specifically against depleted uranium?
It's against weaponizing space. It's against putting weapons in space.
So is there some kind of resolutions that we can pressure our local government, especially our city government, to sign or to look at?
Yes, you need to stop the U.S. Navy from using depleted uranium in your coastal waters. And you can do that using international law. And what you do is you get a resolution going, passed in your city government or your regional government, and that is to inform the public, and then the public begins to pressure the government and elected officials, and then it becomes embarrassing, and then people start demonstrating, and then the Navy just finally folds their tent and disappears into the night.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to be putting on the Elephant Talk website. We'll be putting up the links that you've sent to me of different stories and things. And is there also, do you have any links to perhaps text and wording of resolutions that have been passed already?
Yes, what I'll do is send them to you, and then another very important thing for British Columbia and your cities to do is to pass laws that mandate testing and medical treatment for your Gulf War veterans.
Mm.
And for people to also look into where pension money is being invested for people that have pensions.
Yes, the pension funds.
Okay.
Well, it's been a chilling
shocking
talk, but thanks very much, Loren. And we would like to speak with you again, I'm sure, in the next few months. Maybe when we make some progress with our council and with Nanus, we'll get back to you. So thank you very much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We'll be in touch.
Okay, bye.
And we're out of time, folks. That's it. We were speaking this morning with Loren Morette.
Yeah, she's a geoscientist, and she's one of the world's foremost experts on depleted uranium, and she's also the environmental commissioner for the city of Berkeley.